for today, which is Kuna Mutual Insurance versus Office of Professional Employee International, Local 39.
May it please the court, my name is Philip Miscamara. I'm appearing on behalf of plaintiff appellant CUNA Mutual Insurance Society in this matter. This case, Your Honor, stems from a lawsuit to partially vacate an arbitration award decided by arbitrator Lawrence Cohen. This appeal and the district court action are narrow in two respects. This appeal is narrow because it only concerns our position that the district court improperly imposed Rule 11 sanctions against CUNA Mutual for seeking to partially set aside the Cohen arbitration award. The district court litigation was narrow because it was devoted to the enforcement of contractual limitations on the arbitrator's authority. Now, the main issue in the district court litigation was whether, under CUNA Mutual's labor contract, arbitrators can decide an issue that is different from and broader than the violation alleged in the written grievance. The record shows as to that question, CUNA Mutual's collective bargaining agreement contains specific language giving the arbitrator zero latitude to frame the issue differently from what is stated in the written grievance.
In your position, that's an arbitrability clause, right?
Correct.
It's not an arbitrability clause. You lose, I think.
Well, it also could be regarded as a limitation on the arbitrator's authority. But, in fact, the restriction that I'm referring to is contained in Step 3 of the grievance procedure.
You have to defer to the arbitrator as to the scope of his authority, I believe, but not as to the question of arbitrability, right?
That is absolutely correct.
So if this is not an arbitrability clause, you have a very difficult job on your hands.
If it's strictly did the arbitrator exceed his authority, it's a different standard. But I believe in this case on the facts, CUNA Mutual could even meet that burden. And certainly, since this is a sanctions case, CUNA Mutual meets the burden of pursuing the litigation in good faith.
How could the arbitrator have determined whether the layoffs were necessary as required by the agreement without determining whether the outsourcing was justified?
We have absolutely no dispute with the arbitrator's consideration of the outsourcing as a reason for the layoffs. There is, however, a distinction in framing the issue between claiming that the layoffs violate the collective bargaining agreement and framing the issue differently and maintaining that the outsourcing violates the collective bargaining agreement. And if I may, Judge Rovner, in order to identify the distinction between those two, you only need to do two things. One is, if you actually read the statement of the grievance in the written grievance, it's very clear. It asks the question, or it maintains, that the layoffs violated Article 20 of the collective bargaining agreement, which is the layoff procedure. If you turn instead to page 1 of the arbitrator's award, the arbitrator specifically reframed the issue as, did the company's outsourcing violate the collective bargaining agreement? The second thing, Judge Rovner, if you want to maintain a distinction between the two, look at the arbitrator's award itself. And in the award itself, quoting the union's position, the arbitrator himself differentiated between a no-layoff provision, and he suggested himself in his award that an employer could theoretically engage in outsourcing at will without violating a restriction against layoffs as long as nobody was laid off. So there are clearly two different issues, and that really goes to the crux of this case. And in fact, if you regard labor arbitration as, and I hearken back to the Steelworker Trilogy cases, and specifically Warrior and Gulf, they characterized arbitration as going to the heart of an employer's system of industrial self-government. There can be no more important question in any matter that proceeds to arbitration than what frames the issue in this particular case. So when arbitrator Cohen concluded that he didn't have to regard the written grievance as the formal framing of the issue, even though the collective bargaining agreement said he did, this not only rewrote the agreement, it threatened to profoundly affect every subsequent case.
Well, then what, if anything, should we make of that language of the grievance, which says this grievance is also subject to any other contract violations that are determined after the investigation or grievance process begins?
In fact, that language is unilateral. It's obviously self-serving, and it doesn't square with the collective bargaining agreement's requirement, two requirements. One, that the written grievance identify the specific article and section number alleged to have been violated, and that's in step one of the grievance procedure. And then when you get to the arbitration step, which is step three, it says that specific article and section number shall be the formal framing of the issue if the issue proceeds to arbitration. Or you can say the same thing in reverse. If the issue proceeds to arbitration, the formal framing of the issue shall be the specific article and section cited in the written grievance. Now, perhaps courts or perhaps arbitrators wouldn't fashion the collective bargaining agreement in the same way. But it's very clear under the decided cases, the parties have the ability to tell the arbitrator, you must do X. And it's also very clear in the decided cases, if an arbitrator...
Is it a matter of arbitrability or is it a matter of scope of authority?
Well, in this particular case, the Supreme Court, I'll say it in reverse, the Supreme Court defines substantive arbitrability as whether the subject matter of a particular dispute comes within the party's agreement to arbitrate. In a particular case, and this is borne out in the postal workers Runyon case, which deals with the arbitrator's recitation of the issue, this court in Runyon specifically acknowledged that the arbitrator's definition of the issue can be limited in one of two ways, either in the contract or in the issue submitted for resolution. In this case, both limited the arbitrator's authority. And I might also note, again, this is an appeal limited to the question of whether or not CUNA Mutual had the ability, when an arbitrator appeared to circumvent and, in fact, repudiate explicit language in the collective bargaining agreement, did CUNA Mutual have the ability one time to go into federal court based on a dispute that arose the year after this change had been inserted into the collective bargaining agreement and attempt to enforce this restriction? The one other salient fact I would note to this court is by the time CUNA Mutual received the Cohen Award, which said, in essence, I understand the collective bargaining agreement says I must do this, but arbitrators tend to place substance over form, so I'm not going to. By the time CUNA Mutual received that award from arbitrator Cohen, they had already received a different award from arbitrator Herbert Berman, who in fact looked at the same language, and he concluded that it was binding on an arbitrator. So again, you have, if you ask the question, can the parties, in their collective bargaining agreement, say an arbitrator must do X, is that permissible and enforceable? And of course, the cases are uniform that it is. If an arbitrator says, I understand the agreement says that, but I want to do something else, who wins? And the cases are uniform that the collective bargaining agreement trumps the arbitrator. And in this situation, if you take the district court decision at face value...
The only trouble with that is the arbitrator has the, maybe not the last word, but the most powerful word about what the contract means.
Except when it relates to his authority. And for that reason, we think this is a restriction that goes to the heart of arbitrability. And for that reason, we ask that the district court's imposition of sanctions be reversed on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cobell?
Yes. May it please the Court, Kurt Kobelt on behalf of OPEIU Local 39. The issue before the Court is whether the trial court's determination that CUNA Mutual's challenge to the arbitration was doomed to fail in light of the well-settled law against its position was clearly erroneous. This Rule 11 finding is reviewed under the very highly deferential abuse of discretion standard, which does require a finding of clearly erroneous determination and reasoning by the district court.
Well, what does this provision mean, this business about framing the issue and so on, which I gather that CUNA fought hard to get into this agreement, but if it comes out of this case, it doesn't seem to mean anything.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a relatively routine provision that most arbitrators would probably do anyway. It stands for a very kind of self-evident proposition that a party in an arbitration proceeding cannot, at the arbitration hearing, surprise opposing counsel or surprise the employer with an entirely new and different legal theory that's not even hinted at or suggested by the grievance. Most arbitrators would not allow that anyway. So I don't think this grievance or this particular language does anything more than memorialize in the contract what is a very widespread practice among arbitrators of simply not allowing parties either side to introduce new issues that haven't been previously been fleshed out at the lower levels of the grievance procedure. And I think it's pretty clear in this case that the basic premise of this attack based on this language is that the arbitrator went beyond the grievance that was submitted to him. And I think that is just patently false. Rule 11 requires a basic understanding of the facts. In this case, that is the arbitration decision. The language of the grievance, I think, was misstated by Mr. Miscamara, which states, the employer is implementing a layoff resulting in a reduction of the bargaining unit of up to 25 employees without showing such reduction is necessary in accordance with Article 20, Section 2. Clearly saying you have to show the layoff is necessary, clearly imposing a challenge to the very reason of the layoff, namely the outsourcing.
How do we deal with the point that CUNA makes that the parties should have the ability to rely on the terms of the mutually agreed upon collective bargaining agreement, because this particular agreement had been altered over the course of time to make clear that grievances had to set forth a specific article and section of the agreement. Doesn't it benefit all parties to have, you know, a rule whereby we hold parties to the letter of the bargained for language?
Well, in this case, the arbitrator did, in fact, interpret Article 20 in his opinion. I mean, he stated, if that term is necessary, he said, if that term is to be given effect as it must, then the company is obligated to show there was a legitimate reason which occasioned the layoff. So the arbitrator did, in fact, interpret the contract language cited. Beyond that, certainly the union's position here is that an employer is not entitled to one free, frivolous shot in court. The court below found that what in fact happened here is that in order to evade the deferential standard of review, counsel kind of creatively refashioned this challenge as a substantive arbitrability issue, when in fact the court applied substantive arbitrability to mean you look at two very simple issues. Number one is the subject matter of the dispute, namely outsourcing, something that's been clearly precluded from arbitration by the contract language. For that, you look at the grievance procedure language, which is broadly phrased, as most are, to say basically any dispute. Absent some language in there expressly carving out outsourcing, there's no substantive arbitrability challenge here. So what happened here is that what we have is a refashioning of a real disagreement with the arbitrator's interpretation of the term necessary, which the company doesn't like, doesn't agree with, but knows that it cannot prevail in a legal challenge to a mere disagreement with an arbitrator's interpretation of contract language.
I have to tell you, our court of course, has taken such a hard line on challenges to arbitration awards, it really is somewhat chilling. Maybe somewhere there was a reasonable judge that might have been, not that Judge Crabb is unreasonable. Never, never, never is she unreasonable. But, maybe someone might have been persuaded that Article 29, is it? No, 19 of the agreement imposes a case-by-case substantive limit on disputes that can be submitted to arbitration. I don't know. I'm just musing out loud.
Well, certainly, Rule 11 should not be interpreted in a way that's going to impede or impair creative legal thought.
Amounts to applying the English rule to arbitrations. If you lose the arbitration, you pay.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think what it amounts to is an application of common law rules of pleading from ancient England to the arbitration procedure by focusing on a purely formalistic dispute with the wording of the grievance, which at any rate is a wrong interpretation of the grievance or how the arbitrator looked at it.
Which construed or interpreted this section 19 or 20, whatever it is, and we can't challenge that unless that section is an arbitrability clause. Isn't that what it boils down to?
That's correct.
We have to accept whatever he says
unless it's a matter
of arbitrability.
Right, and it's not. I think it's pretty clear from
that's your position. I mean,
unless it's there's two kinds of arbitrability. There's substantive and there's procedural. In this case, you only get a de novo review for substantive arbitrability. This issue regarding the wording of a grievance is purely a procedural arbitrability, not regarding the subject matter of the dispute, and therefore is subject to the deferential standard, which counsel cannot avoid being subjected to in this case. And certainly, Dreesen Krumpf was barely cited by counsel in its briefing below, and certainly counsel in the approximately 6 or 10 days between the issuance of a decision and the filing of this lawsuit, I think it's pretty apparent counsel didn't do his homework in carefully examining the law of this circuit, particularly Dreesen Krumpf, and deciding if, in fact, he had a case. And I think that's particularly illustrated by this other argument they make, which was done with equal force below, that by retaining jurisdiction in this case, the court somehow violated the principle that an arbitration award should be final and binding. I don't think anyone can read Dreesen Krumpf's discussion of the jurisdiction issue, how the arbitrator in that case retained jurisdiction, and why that was basically an acceptable procedure, and believe that there's any viable claim to challenge an arbitrator's retention of jurisdiction. That is standard operating practice in virtually all arbitrations, is for an arbitrator, when he sustains a grievance, to direct the parties to try to work out the damages themselves, and if they're not able to do so, come back to him, and he will resolve that. That was an integral part of this appeal, and that is clearly foreclosed, I believe, by the court's decision in Dreesen Krumpf. Finally, this other reliance on an arbitration decision issued by arbitrator Berman, I think, is even more questionable. That decision was issued well before the briefing in this case, yet strangely and inexplicably was not even cited by counsel to arbitrator Cohen. If he wanted to cite that decision at that time, that was the appropriate thing to do. Arbitrator Cohen may or may not have given way to it. He's not bound by it. But for counsel to wait until a court proceeding to cite that decision, I think really raises more questions than it answers. And at any rate, simply because an arbitrator in a different case applied that language in a way that precluded a certain argument from being heard, I don't think it has any bearing whatsoever as to whether the counsel in this case based on that prior decision, had grounds to mount a legal challenge on an arbitration award, which clearly applies accepted legal principles endorsed by this court specifically in Dreesen Crump.
Don't think that case, the outcome of that case goes to the question of the propriety of bringing this action in the federal court, even though it may not be of interest to the arbitrator in deciding the case. Don't you think it goes to the propriety of the bringing the federal action after?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it's an arbitration decision to bring a propriety to meet your obligations under Rule 11 requires that you look at the law of this circuit to determine if you have a viable cause of action. Another arbitration decision simply interpreting the language you're challenging and challenging disingenuously under a substantive arbitrability issue, I think is an entirely different proceeding, which counsel failed to do here and for that reason deserves sanctions.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle.
Thank you.
You have 1 minute, counsel.
I will just make 2 points, Your Honors. Dreesen Crump, obviously, in multiple respects, is the poster child reflecting a frivolous employer's effort to overturn an arbitration award. The employer blew the statute of limitations. It didn't raise any issue that involved a restriction on the arbitrator's authority except to say that the Management Rights Clause precluded the arbitrator from considering the issue. That argument had been rejected 25 years earlier in the Steelworkers Trilogy cases. Dreesen Crump is a completely different case from what we're dealing with here. And in fact, CUNA Mutual did exactly what Dreesen and Crump prescribed that an employer should do when it confronts a non-arbitrable issue in an arbitration proceeding where there's at least some viable basis for the employer being in the room. With respect to the damages issue, that's addressed, I think, effectively in our brief. I will just note that the district court cited two different decisions with respect to the question about damages and the retention of authority. One was Dreesen and Crump, and in that case, the retention of jurisdiction was considered by the arbitrator as whether that extended the statute of limitations. And in the second case cited by the district court, that court specifically rejected the request that the court impose sanctions on the employer raising the argument. And I think that dispositively addresses the question of good faith for purposes of Rule 11 as it relates to that issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.